Hello, and welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capitol Week, where we explore and analyze who and what have been making news at Iowa State Capitol, including the governor, lawmakers, and legislation that's in the works or could be in the works, and what it means for all of us. I'm Dennis Hart, and I'm joined, as always, by Laura Bellin of the must-read political blog site Bleeding Heartland. Laura, good to be with you, as always, again on Capitol Week.
Nice to talk with you, Dennis.
We have so much to talk about. Let's jump right in. Starting with the fact that this is scheduled to be, Laura, as you know, the last week of the 2021 state legislative session, and not one budget bill has passed both chambers. And the bills that the Republican-controlled state Senate and House have moved out of their committees are far apart on both money and policy. Laura, what's going on here?
Well, the legislators stopped receiving their per diem allowance on April 30th, and they are just not close to finishing the work. And it's one thing when you have a divided legislature like we had from 2011 through 2016. We had Democrats in control of the Senate and Republicans in control of the House. And some of those years, we went really far over time, more than a month over the scheduled work session. But with Republicans in control of everything at the state house, it's hard to understand exactly what's going on with the budget. But for one, one of the big things is that the Senate Republicans opted out of the joint budget subcommittees that have happened every year for 50 years or more. I've talked to people who followed the legislature for many decades, and no one can ever remember a chamber just opting out of that joint budget process.
So what happens if by Friday night they don't have a budget?
Well, they'll just keep working. I mean, there have been many years where they went over their time. They just won't receive their per diems for the days that they're working. The legislative, some of the staff, the clerks won't be there to help them with the work, but they will at some point. I expect probably within the next 2 to 3 weeks, certainly, probably at sometime by the end of next week, they'll have all the work done. I still hear that Republican leaders are hoping that they can finish everything this week. I just think that will be a very tight squeeze.
So we talked about their being far apart on what they have gotten done. State House, for example, has proposed a $20 million increase for state prisons. The Senate has proposed a $6 million hike. All of this coming in the wake of the Anamosa state prison double killing about a month ago. How in the world do they split the difference on this one? Where do you see this going?
I don't know. I mean, I think that they will probably find some way to split the difference. I think if the governor weighed in, that would probably be helpful to figuring out what if the legislators know what the governor wants to see, then that can sometimes influence these final backroom deals.
Now, you mentioned that, and on Monday afternoon, Kathy Obradovich of the Iowa Capitol Dispatch website reported that the legislature is far apart. They haven't passed the budget. And she demanded essentially that the governor step in and do something. What exactly can the governor do besides try to jawbone this thing?
Well, she can't really control the budget process, but she could communicate more clearly what she wants to see and what she's unwilling to sign. And I think that that would speed things along. Right now, there are several bills in limbo. One of them, for instance, with the Health and Human Services budget, there's a dispute over whether they would approve parity for telehealth services for mental health. The House wants to see that happen. They voted for it twice. The Senate hasn't moved that bill. If the governor said, hey, I want to see this in the budget, that would be something that could probably move them closer to an agreement. But that's the kind of thing. And on any of the budget bills, there she could probably signal what she would like to see. The higher education budget is another one where they still don't have consensus.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, you mentioned that the House has proposed a zero increase in money for state universities. The Senate has proposed a $6 million increase. The House, it seems to be, it has some people in there who want to punish state universities. We've talked about this before, for what they perceive to be cutting down on discourse among conservatives on campus. Again, where do you see this one possibly going?
Well, it's going to be tough for the universities. One of the big sticking points in that budget is that the House wants to impose a tuition freeze, and the Senate hasn't supported that language. And that would be another area where if the governor indicated, hey, I'm not signing a tuition freeze into law, for instance, or conversely, I'd like to sign a tuition freeze into law, that would be something that could help remove the logjam. But remember that even if they agree to increase this higher education budget by $6 million or $8 million, that's not nearly enough of an increase to keep up with inflation. The state universities and community colleges, they have fixed costs like salaries that go up by a certain amount every year. And so if the state appropriation stays relatively flat, they're going to have to make cuts. In real terms, that works out to a cut.
Well, let's talk about the coronavirus. Everybody else is across the country. Governor Reynolds said last week that vaccine hesitancy starting to become a factor in Iowa. She asked residents to get vaccinated, and she used the words, if you're opting to wait and see, what are you waiting for? And today, 80 of 90 Iowa's 99 counties have declined their allocation of coronavirus vaccine. 80 of the 99 because there's not that much demand. So what's going on do you see there? The governor has been vaccinated with the J&J vaccine. She has endorsed it. She said she'd do it again. And yet so many Iowans are not getting vaccinated.
Well, the supply increased much more quickly than people thought would happen a couple of months ago. So part of what happened is that when the state opened up eligibility to all adults on April 5th, a lot of people rushed to get vaccinated. So we were administering more shots the first couple weeks of this month. But 2 weeks ago, the Iowa Department of Public Health said that 19 counties had declined their allocation. Last week, they said 43 counties, and now they say 80 counties. And initially, it was mostly rural counties, heavily Republican areas. So it's not surprising that you'd see a lot of skepticism about the vaccine. But now that it's affecting some urban areas as well, I mean, it's worrying. And it's not clear how much of it is people who adamantly do not want to be vaccinated and how much is people who passively maybe would like to get a vaccine, but they just haven't figured out how to schedule an appointment. Maybe they don't have internet at home. Maybe they work odd hours, long shifts, and they just haven't been able to figure out a time. So the state is going to need to do, and local public health will need to do more outreach to try to get to some of the people who probably would be willing to get vaccinated. I also think I've read several medical experts say that if they just made at least the Moderna and the J&J vaccines available at regular doctor's offices, those are the ones that don't need the extreme levels of refrigeration. If they made those available at doctor's offices, then physicians could offer those when people come in for their annual physical or for some other reason. And there might be a lot of people who wouldn't go out of their way to schedule a special COVID vaccination appointment. But if they were already at the doctor's office and they said, hey, would you like this shot? Especially if it's the Johnson & Johnson shot where they don't have to come back again in 3 weeks, there might be a lot of people who would take them up on that.
Well, while all this is going on Monday afternoon, the Iowa House took the first step toward banning so-called vaccine passports. The Judiciary Committee in the House advanced a bill prohibiting state or local governments from including a person's coronavirus vaccination status on an ID card. The governor has said she wants to ban so-called vaccine passports. So this is a step toward that. Senator Stephen Holt, by the way, State Senator Stephen Holt, Republican from Denison, said he believes such passport requirements are, quote, un-American and unconstitutional. So this has become one of those partisan issues again, like so much else in the United States.
Well, I listened to the subcommittee meeting. The judiciary, they had a committee of the whole met in subcommittee and then immediately approved the bill through the whole committee as well. It was kind of a strange subcommittee meeting because the public comments normally in the Iowa legislature, they alternate speakers who support the bill and oppose the bill. But basically, nobody showed up to this meeting to oppose the bill. All of the speakers were supporting the idea of banning vaccine passports. And the main thrust of most of the comments was that they wanted the bill amended. Right now, it has an exception for businesses in the healthcare field, so hospitals and nursing homes primarily. And many of the speakers were extremely upset about that they didn't like the idea that a hospital or a nursing home could still require you to show that you've had a COVID-19 vaccine in order to come visit someone or in order to work there. And there was someone speaking on behalf of the Iowa Hospital Association saying, hey, please don't amend this bill because we need to keep people safe. So it was voted out of committee without too much trouble. It was actually a bipartisan vote. Several of the Democrats on the committee did vote to advance the bill. But I think that there will probably be some kind of battle before it comes up on the House floor over whether they approve an amendment that will take out this health care exemption, because the vaccine opponents were really upset about the idea that that hospitals and nursing homes might still be able to require this vaccine.
Or private businesses.
Well, the other private businesses the law would apply to them. So most private businesses they would not be able to say you can only be our client or customer or on our premises if you've had a vaccine. But there is an exemption written into the law currently, or the draft bill rather. There is an exemption written into it for healthcare businesses.
As we say, it's become one of those partisan issues like everything else in the country. And again, while all this is going on, the state auditor, Rob Sand, who may or may not be running for governor or U.S. Senate. We don't know yet. He criticized the governor's pandemic response, saying the state is sitting on about $1 billion while businesses struggle to survive. Where's the billion?
Well, it's in different accounts. About $300 million is in a surplus, a budget surplus, and then there are different rainy day accounts that have hundreds of millions in them. And this is something Rob Sanders talked about before. In December, before the legislature came back to work, he said, hey, it's raining right now, and let's not hoard the umbrellas. And he called a press conference and said, we have a lot of businesses that are hurting, a lot of people in Iowa are hurting, and instead of just waiting to see what funding the federal government will come up with, state legislators and the governor should also approve additional state funding to support businesses. And we've seen, for instance, with the restaurants and bars, that there wasn't enough money to go around to all of the restaurants that lost business last year. And so there have been a series of stories in the Des Moines Register about different types of establishments that didn't qualify for the state's the way the state was distributing the federal COVID relief funding. And so Rob Sand is saying, look, you know, we should be helping as many of these businesses to get through the pandemic as possible, because especially in smaller communities, these restaurants or bars are sometimes they almost function like a community center. It's like a gathering place for the town.
All right, let's talk about crime and punishment. Three of Iowa's top Democrats last week requested a federal investigation into the state's prison system after the killings of two Anamosa State Penitentiary employees. So they are asking essentially for an investigation. The governor's formally requested an outside review of safety and security. Later in the week, seven of the state's state legislature's Democrats toured the Anamosa prison, said the legislature's Republican lawmakers need to add hundreds of correctional officers and other staff. So here's the fight. Democrats say more money needs to be pumped in, a lot more. We talked about this just a few minutes ago. Republicans are hesitant on this prison issue, but the prison issue cuts pretty deeply into Iowa culture and politics. Where does this one go, do you think?
Well, one of the issues, in addition to the funding shortfall and the staffing shortfall, is that in 2017, when the Republicans changed the collective bargaining law that applied to public employees, most public employees lost the right to bargain over anything other than their base wages. And that included most of the correction workers, which are covered by the AFSCME union. So when their contracts come up right now, they can only bargain over wages. They cannot bargain over any workplace safety or other working condition issues. And so that's one of the things. Democrats have been upset about this for years, and they've been complaining for years that they feel that the correction system is understaffed right now. I think that with the Republicans, so far their strategy just seems to be to discount that money had anything to do with what happened at Anamosa, and just to say, you know, well, we'll just have to wait and see what an investigation shows. But Democrats are politicizing this issue, so it doesn't really seem like there's a good chance that they'll get on the same page. But I think that requesting a federal investigation, I mean, that's something that's only possible because the Biden administration is in Washington. I think if the Trump administration were around, it's not likely that Democrats would imagine that a federal investigation would produce the kind of accountability that they'd like to see.
Okay. Preliminary census reports, the results came out on Monday afternoon, showing that Iowa gained a little bit of population, 3.2 million people there. And this is going to affect redistricting. And you have some new information about how that redistricting process might take place in Iowa. So why don't we unpack that one?
Yes. Well, today the Census Bureau released the state population numbers. This is not the detailed data that's going to be needed to start drawing new maps, but it's the numbers that show how many representatives in the U.S. House all the states will have. And as expected, Iowa hangs on to its four congressional districts. Our state population increased by about 4.7%. Most states in the country grew by more than that. So I'm a little bit concerned that we might be on a track to lose one of our congressional districts after the 2030 census. We'll have to see how that goes. But the main thing that we learned today from the Census Bureau in Washington is the total population of the state. That tells us what the ideal population for the next congressional districts will be. So each of the congressional districts will have to be pretty close to about 797,000 people, just under 800,000. The ideal population for a Iowa House district will be just under 32,000, and for an Iowa Senate district, just under 64,000. But the news that we got from the State Legislative Services Agency, that was more exciting for me, because the Census Bureau is going to release some of the detailed population data in an unusual format in August. And it looks like our state's Legislative Services Agency, which is the nonpartisan staff who draw up the possible maps, they are going to be able to access the data in that format. Last month, when we asked about this, that we were told, well, we don't know yet whether that data will be usable for us. But it sounds like the nonpartisan commission might be able to start drawing a new map sometime in August. And that means that the Iowa legislature might have time to vote on a proposal before there's a deadline in the Constitution that says they have to approve new maps by September 1st, and those have to become law by September 15th. Otherwise, the Iowa Supreme Court takes over that process. So we still don't know exactly when the census is going to give us that detailed population data, but at least there's a chance that the legislature might be able to vote on a nonpartisan map before September.
Well, we're going to wait and see. You and I will be around to talk about that one in September or before. It is 15 and a half minutes after the hour. This is KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week. We're about halfway done. And I'm Dennis Hart, along with Laura Bellin, the never-sleeping Laura Bellin, who is always writing on her wonderful must-read blog site, Bleeding Heartland. It is outstanding. She never sleeps. She's writing in the middle of the night. And one of the things you wrote, Laura, is that the Secretary of State's office in Iowa had wrongly inactivated lots of Iowa voters. This is a very big deal. How did it happen and what does it mean?
Well, it's related to that big election law that Republicans passed earlier this year that we talked about on a few shows. So when we talked about the law, we mostly focused on the new restrictions to early voting, the shorter amount of time to vote on election day. And we talked a little bit about this moving voters to inactive status, but we didn't spend a lot of time on it. But in the past, you wouldn't be moved to inactive status as a voter unless you didn't vote at all for 4 years in a row. If you voted in no elections for 4 years and didn't update your voter registration information, you'd be moved to inactive status. Under the new law, if you miss one general election, you're moved to inactive status. And so the Secretary of State's office went to implement that law this month, and they sent notices to hundreds of thousands of Iowans who didn't vote in the 2020 election. And that was, I mean, they sent the notices to some Iowans who were 17-year-olds who had registered to vote, but weren't old enough to vote. So they couldn't actually cast a ballot, but they were just registered at age 17 and a half, which is allowed under state law. And then they got these notices in the mail that said, well, now you're inactive because you didn't vote. And also there were even some deceased people whose registrations had been canceled by their county auditors because they died after the general election. And some of those people were mistakenly moved to inactive status as well. So it's going to be a headache for the close to 300,000 Iowans who receive these cards. They either have to correct their voter registration information, or if they don't notice the card or they don't do anything about the mailing, next time they show up to vote, they might have to jump through more hoops to prove that they're actually registered at the address where they live.
300,000 Iowans is a lot of Iowans to be inactivated.
Well, and it's going to be more after the next election because, as we know, hundreds of thousands of people vote only in presidential years and don't vote in midterm elections. So it's expected that probably at least 300,000 or 400,000 people who voted in the 2020 general election will not vote in the 2022 midterm. And in the spring of 2023, all of those people are going to get mailings informing them that they've been moved to inactive status. And so when those people show up to vote in the 2024 general election, the presidential race, as many of them will, they may get a surprise when they show up at their polling place and they're expected to show proof of address because they're no longer on that active voter list. They're on the inactive list.
And surprise, you can't vote.
Well, they might be able to vote. I mean, if their driver's license shows their current address where they're registered, they should be able to clear it up quickly. But if they've moved since they last renewed their driver's license, they may have to show some other proof of address, like a rental agreement or a utility bill. And of course, people don't carry those documents around with them. So they would then have to go home to get that and come back to the polling place. I mean, it's going to be a major inconvenience for presidential only year voters. And that's why Democrats didn't support this change. They felt that people should only be moved to inactive status if they haven't voted in two full election cycles. So one full presidential and one full midterm election cycle.
All part of that Iowa election law that the legislature put together a few weeks ago. One of the 43 states that are considering election restrictions following the 2020 presidential election, in which there was no evidence whatsoever of any fraud. And yet Republicans in many state legislatures, and it is Republicans in those state legislatures, working in effect to tighten up requirements to restrict how easy it is to vote.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, it's a trend we've seen all over the country, and particularly targeting early voting, because in recent years, Democrats have been more likely to vote before Election Day.
Yep. You also wrote that an Iowa law that blocks some health care for transgender Iowans is the object of a new legal attack in the state. I'm not sure a lot of people know about this law, but let's talk about that.
Well, this is the story begins 2 years ago today, on April 26th of 2019, when the day before the legislature adjourned for the year, the Republicans in the Senate added an amendment to the Health and Human Services budget that said essentially the goal was to ban Medicaid coverage for gender-affirming surgery for transgender Iowans. The Iowa Supreme Court had recently ruled, they'd ruled in March of 2019, that a state policy on Medicaid not covering that transition surgery was a violation of the Iowa Civil Rights Act, which protects against discrimination on the basis of gender identity and sexual orientation. So the legislature, instead of just letting that be, letting the Iowa Supreme Court ruling stand, they snuck an amendment to the Iowa Civil Rights Act into that budget bill. And they said this act essentially can't be construed to require health coverage of a gender reassignment surgery for transgender people. And so the ACLU of Iowa sued very soon after the governor signed that into law. They filed a lawsuit on behalf of two transgender Iowans who receive health care through Medicaid. And I expected actually that that lawsuit would be successful. But what happened was the district court and later the Iowa Court of Appeals ruled that it was not what the official judicial term is ripe. It was not ripe for consideration because these Iowans had not exhausted their resources of trying to get Medicaid to cover their surgery first. So they had to go back and request that their healthcare providers, that Medicaid cover the surgery. And now they have officially, at least one of them has officially been denied. The other one is still pending with the Iowa Department of Human Services. And so they're going to be back in court saying this is unconstitutional to prohibit the coverage of medically necessary surgery for Iowans just because they are transgender. And now the courts won't be able to toss the case. In the past, the last lawsuit, no one ever considered the merits of the case because they just said that it wasn't time for judicial review. So now a district court and eventually, I'm sure, the Iowa Supreme Court will have to decide, is it constitutional for the state of Iowa to say Medicaid doesn't have to cover your surgery if you're transgender? And, you know, one thing that the lawsuit pointed out is that if you need a mastectomy to treat cancer, of course, Medicaid would cover that. But if you need a mastectomy because your doctor says that that's a medically necessary treatment for your gender dysphoria, Medicaid would not cover it. So sometimes the exact same surgical procedures would be denied solely because of a person's gender identity.
You have also been reporting that what you called a longstanding effort by Iowa Senate Republicans to reduce the number of residents getting various forms of public assistance had gotten a boost from Governor Reynolds. Can you unpack that one?
Yes, this was really in the weeds, in the legislative weeds here, because the Iowa Senate, particularly State Senator Jason Schultz, this has been one of his top priorities for 4 years in a row now, to try to establish a new system similar to what they've done in Arkansas and Kentucky and some other states. The result would be to reduce the number of people on Medicaid and some other forms of public assistance. And this bill this year also would set new asset tests to qualify for federal food assistance. It's called SNAP. Most people still call it food stamps, but the asset limits would be really low. I mean, a household with two cars might not qualify for food assistance. And it would be, I mean, in rural Iowa, a lot of times you don't have to be wealthy to have two cars, to have two people working in the household and have different jobs and each need a vehicle to get there. So in any case, each year the Senate has approved this bill and it has died in the House Human Resources Committee because House Republicans aren't interested in advancing this legislation. And the same thing happened again this year. And so it was ostensibly it was dead, but the governor, she submits draft budget bills to the legislature every year, and few people other than the legislators, their staff and the lobbyists, few people read through these budget bills. But alarm bells went off a couple of weeks ago, because when the governor's budget, health and human services budget, was published, it included this provision about increasing asset tests for food assistance and a new eligibility verification system for Medicaid and the other assistance. And so it was like a quiet signal to legislators that this is what the governor wants to see in the budget. So the Senate Republicans, then they revived that bill, most of the language from it, and they added to their human services budget. So now the question is, what will the House Republicans do about it? The House Republicans have signaled that they are not interested in this in the past. And will that change now that the governor quietly signaled her support? We'll find out probably in the next week or so.
You have also been reporting that Iowa Congresswomen Ashley Hinson and Marionette Miller Meeks were among dozens of House Republicans who had received campaign donations from a disgraced Republican donor whose name happens to be Stephen Wynn. I believe this is a Bleeding Heartland exclusive, so give it to us if you would.
So this is why I always look through the actual campaign finance filings, because this was buried deep in the first quarter reports filed with the Federal Election Commission. The candidates for Congress, they have to report all of their individual contributions and PAC contributions, but they also have to report transfers from other committees. And this is where this donation from Steve Wynn came in, because the House Minority Leader, Kevin McCarthy, he has a leadership committee. And he got huge donations. He raised more than $20 million from mostly from very large donors. And several of the donors, Steve Wynn was one of them, gave over $770,000 each. And then his committee divided that up and they sent the maximum allowable individual contribution. So for this cycle, it's $5,800. And they sent that out. They transferred that to dozens of other House Republican committees, including Ashley Hinson and Marionette Miller Meeks. Now, I was not the first to discover this transfer from Kevin McCarthy's committee. That was first reported by the Associated Press. They have a reporter in Washington, Brian Slidisco, who follows campaign finance very closely. But when I saw in his story that funding from Steve Wynn was transferred to at least 55 House Republicans, I thought, I bet Iowa's two representatives on the east part of the state, I bet they're on that list, because both Ashley Hinson and Marionette Miller Meeks are expected to have competitive races next year. Of course, a lot will depend on what the map looks like. But generally speaking, eastern Iowa is competitive territory. So I wasn't able to get comments from either of their campaigns on whether they plan to keep the money or return the money or donate the money to charity. In 2018, a lot of Republican members of Congress returned or donated to charity money from Steve Wynn, because the Wall Street Journal had reported that there were many credible allegations of sexual harassment and even some of sexual assault by former employees of his casinos and spas. And I should say that Steve Wynn has denied all of those allegations, but he did step down from his role as Republican National Committee Finance Chair at that time.
We have about 90 seconds left, so quickly. Lawmakers in the state house last week approved spending $100 million for broadband expansion in the state. Now, that falls $50 million short of what Governor Reynolds has asked for. And she apparently believes she can cover that shortfall by using federal money. How would that work?
Well, it all depends on what kind of infrastructure bill the Congress passes. But certainly the Biden administration has proposed a lot of broadband money as part of that infrastructure package. And so if something gets through Congress that's anything like what the Biden administration has proposed, I think Iowa probably will receive tens of millions of dollars in federal assistance on that front.
About a minute left in the Senate, a state Senate, a bill advanced that would give school principals the power to waive mask requirements to let children attend in-person classes without a facial covering. How does this change existing procedures right now?
Well, the big confusion with that bill is, does that mean that principals can overturn the policy set by their own school boards? And the bill doesn't really specify that. So I think that that bill is a little bit half-baked, and I don't really see the Iowa House advancing it in that form. I think they'll have to make some changes to it.
I like that phrase, half-baked. What's coming up on the legislative agenda for this week? It's the last week, allegedly, probably not. What do you expect to happen here?
Well, the budget is the big thing, but we still have to see whether the Iowa House moves that abortion constitutional amendment. The Senate sent it back with slightly different wording, as we discussed a week or two ago, and it's still sitting there on the House Majority Leader's desk, and it's not on the debate calendar as far as I know.
Laura, it has been a pleasure again being with you. I hope you have a great and busy week.
As always, I'm sure it'll be. I do sleep, for the record.
We are just about out of time. You have been listening to Capital Week on KHOI Community Radio. Laura and I will be right back here in this same time slot next week, we promise, with a look at what makes news with the governor and with the Iowa State Legislature, and yes, what it means for all of us. Until then, thank you so much for the privilege of your time, and we hope you have a great week.